So we've talked about how the Old Testament reveals God to us through his mighty acts, that is the narration of his mighty acts in space and time, in history, as well as through figurative language, the use of metaphor and simile. And we're going to begin by reflecting on God as revealed in his mighty acts. And I said at the end of last session that our primary example is going to be from the book of Exodus, and we're going to get to the book of Exodus shortly. But before we do, I want to talk a little bit about the intersection of history and theology by taking a look at the so-called synoptic issue in the Old Testament. People are very familiar with the synoptic gospels and issues that are raised by the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, each giving account of Jesus's life and ministry, but with slightly different perspectives. So in the Old Testament, we have a synoptic issue presented to us by Samuel Kings on the one hand and the Book of Chronicles on the other hand. And the reason why we're going to study this issue is because, again, it's going to show us the intersection of theology and history in a dramatic way, because if you've studied Samuel Kings synoptically with Chronicles, you see just how significantly different a picture of the history you get between Samuel Kings and Chronicles. Matter of fact, the different perspective on the history in Samuel Kings from Chronicles is quite dramatically more significant than the different perspectives you get on the life and ministry of Christ in the three synoptic gospels. And so, first of all, I'm going to describe the difference and then talk about the reason why you have the different perspective, and ultimately come back to the question of, can these two accounts both be historically true? And let me take away the suspense by saying I will argue yes, they can both be historically true, but that we shouldn't move to harmonize right away. We should first of all come to appreciate the theological significance of the difference. So let me begin, as I said, by illustrating the different approaches to the history that Samuel Kings takes from Chronicles. And I'll begin by comparing the account of a relatively minor king whose name is Abijah. Though we'll see, even in terms of the name, there's a difference between Samuel Kings and Chronicles, though it's certainly the same individual. His father is the same and his son is the same. But in Samuel Kings, in the Hebrew text, the king is called Abijam or Aviyam. So let's begin by turning to 1 Kings. First Kings 16, and First Kings 15, verses 1 through 8. And the ESV, which I'm reading from, does the right thing and keeps the name Abiyam in the text. In the NIV, if you're using the NIV or some other translations, it'll harmonize by putting Abijah or Aviyah in the text and then footnoting Abiyam. But even the NIV translators whom I talk to know that Aviyam is the stronger text. In the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abiyam began to reign over Judah. He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maakah, the daughter of Abishalom. And he walked in all the sins that his father did before him. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father. Nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the manner of Uriah the Hittite. Now there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. The rest of the acts of Abiyam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And there was war between Abiyam and Jeroboam, and Abiyam slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his place. So at this point, let me just highlight the fact that he's referred to as Abiyam. His mother, Maakah's father, is given as Abishalom, who's the famous Absalom of the previous narrative, David's son, who's a negative figure. And that all that we learn about this king is negative. He's not a good king. He doesn't follow the Lord. Now let's turn to the chronicler's account of this king, which we find in 2 Chronicles chapter 13. In the 18th year of King Jeroboam, that's the name that's given, began to reign over Judah. He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maakah, the daughter of, not Absalom, but of Uriel of Gibeah. Now there was war between Abiyah and Jeroboam. Abiyah went out to battle, having an army of valiant men of war, 400,000 chosen men, and Jeroboam drew up his line of battle against him with 800,000 chosen mighty warriors. Then Abiyah stood up on Mount Zemaraim, that is in the hill country of Ephraim, and said, "Hear me, O Jeroboam and all of Israel. Ought you not to know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingship over to Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt? Yet Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, a servant of Solomon, the son of David, rose up and rebelled against his Lord. And certain worthless scoundrels gathered about him and defied Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, when Rehoboam was young and irresolute and could not withstand them. And now you think to withstand the kingdom of the Lord in the hand of the sons of David, because you are a great multitude and have with you the golden calves that Jeroboam made you for gods? Have you not driven out the priests of the Lord, the sons of Aaron and the Levites, and made priests for yourselves like the priests of other lands? Whoever comes for ordination with a young bull or seven rams becomes a priest of what are no gods. But as for us, the Lord is our God, and we have not forsaken him. We have priests ministering to the Lord who are sons of Aaron and Levites for their service. They offer to the Lord every morning and every evening burnt offerings and incense of sweet spices, set out the showbread on the table of pure gold, and care for the golden lampstand that its lamps may burn every evening. For we keep the charge of the Lord our God, but you have forsaken him. Behold, God is with us at our head, and his priests with their battle trumpets to sound the call to battle against you, O sons of Israel. Do not fight against the Lord, the God of your fathers, for you cannot succeed." Now, this speech goes on for a number more verses. You can read them, but you'll see that here, this king who was described in such a negative way in Samuel Kings and Kings is here described as a faithful follower of God and giving this magnificent, pious pre-battle war sermon to the forces from the north. So And you'll see if you read the rest of Chronicles that there's not a negative word said about this king in Chronicles. Now, what are we to make of this? And first of all, let me point out that this is not unique to this one narrative. This is sort of a consistent theme throughout Samuel Kings, which paints a negative picture of God's people, and Chronicles, which paints a consistently positive view. It's not that there are no negative stories. I'll talk about them, but in a moment, and the reason why they're there. But certainly, if you read it synoptically, you'll not miss the fact that they're quite dramatically different. I mean, even take Manasseh. Manasseh, one of the last kings of Judah, Josiah, the good King Josiah's grandfather. Read the account in Kings, and you'll see he is a despicable person. He worships false gods. He sacrifices his son. He engages in necromancy and divination, and you name it, he does it. And when you turn to Chronicles, yes, that's all there, to be sure. But what you learn in Chronicles that you don't learn in Kings is that at the end of his life, Manasseh repented. Manasseh repented, turned to the Lord. The author of Samuel Kings chooses not to tell us about that. Or even compare the account of Solomon asking for wisdom at Gibeon in Kings. I think it's 1 Kings 3 and 2 Chronicles 1. Now, both agree that this was a good thing that he asked for wisdom and not for wealth and so forth. But notice as you read the account in Kings that the author of Kings can't help but sort of give a negative coloring to the text when it talks about how Solomon was a good king, except that he worshiped at the high places and that Gibeon was the primary high place. You turn to Chronicles and you learn that what you don't learn in Kings, which is that the tabernacle was at Gibeon. So that puts a more positive light on what Solomon was doing at that time. And certainly the author of Kings knew well that the law of centralization, which we're going to talk about in a moment from Deuteronomy 12, has not yet come into effect. It doesn't come into effect until the construction of the temple later in Solomon's reign. So the author of Samuel Kings can't help but be critical of Solomon even at this early point. And it's a fair assessment because of Solomon's later life. So that's the issue. The issue is these two different portraits of Samuel Kings and Chronicles. Now, let's ask the question, why? Why is Samuel Kings negative and Chronicles positive? And the answer comes in by looking at who was the original audience of Samuel Kings and of Chronicles. Samuel Kings was written during the exile, or at least it came into its final form at the time of the exile. How do we know that? We know that because the last event that's narrated in the book is the release of King Jehoiachin from a Babylonian prison during the reign of a Babylonian king named Emel-Marduk, or in Hebrew, it's Evil-Merodach. And we know that Evil-Merodach was king 562 to 560 BC, which is smack in the middle of the exile. So Samuel Kings is writing his account of Israel's history to answer questions of his contemporary audience. And the main question is, what did we do to deserve this? What did we do to deserve being taken into exile? So the author of Samuel Kings, we don't know who wrote the book. And by the way, Samuel Kings are really one book, not four different books, but they couldn't appear on one scroll. So Samuel Kings is answering that question, looking back over the history of Judah and Israel and choosing those stories that will answer that question. Whereas Chronicles is written during the post-exilic period. We know that because the last narrated event is the so-called Cyrus Decree, where the Persian king Cyrus issued a decree that allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem and commence the construction of the temple. And some of the genealogies indicate that it's probably even a little later than the immediate post-exilic period. My point, though, would be if it's being written during the post-exilic period, the questions are no longer, what are we doing in exile? The questions are more like, how do we connect to the past after this incredible disruption of our history? And secondly, now how do we act? Now how do we act? So I'm going to explore a little bit further how Samuel Kings, on the one hand, and Chronicles answers those questions. But we first of all need to realize that they're answering these questions and they're treating the history kind of like a good preacher will preach a biblical text. You know, there's not just one sermon that comes from a biblical text. The sermon on the same text will, of course, have a lot of commonality because of the meaning of the text. And I'm not arguing that a good preacher will adopt different interpretations of the text to meet the needs of their audience, but a good preacher will preach a text and apply it to the questions and needs of their congregation as they're aware of it. And that's what's going on here with the authors of Samuel Kings on the one hand and Chronicles on the other hand. They're preaching from the history of Israel and applying it to the questions that they have at the moment. So, how does Samuel Kings approach the question of why are we in exile? Well, interestingly, Samuel Kings is looking at the history of Israel and Judah through the prism of the book of Deuteronomy. It's using Deuteronomy as the standard and saying, how did we measure up to keeping the law? And it's uniquely laws from Deuteronomy. And this is the reason why many scholars will refer to Samuel Kings, if not, you know, Joshua Judges Samuel Kings, as the Deuteronomic history. Now, some evangelicals don't like that term because it often comes with the idea that Deuteronomy was written during the 7th century BC. That's not where I'm coming from. I do think that Deuteronomy accurately reflects a sermon that Moses gave much earlier, but still, Samuel Kings is using Deuteronomy as a evaluative guide to the history of Judah and Israel. And specifically, looking at four laws. Number one, the law of centralization in Deuteronomy 12. Number two, the law of the prophet in Deuteronomy 13 and 18. Number three, the law of kingship in Deuteronomy 17, verse 14 and following. And then finally, it's not a law, but the curses of the covenant that you find in Deuteronomy 27 and 28. Now, when we come to the book of Chronicles, we see that they're answering a different question. So they're not using Deuteronomy as this evaluation. But this is what we're going to do in the next session, we're going to look, after having seen the issue, we're now going to look at how Samuel Kings answers its question using those laws from Deuteronomy, and how Chronicles answers its questions using a different strategy.